So, but tonight I'm very happy to welcome Craig Cross here at Many Roots. He just told me that we were the first store to feature the Goddess coloring book. So that's kind of cool. I like
that. I was very happy as a lamb.
And it's been, you know, people really like it. We have it, you know, on a face out on a table, and people really like it. And as Craig was saying, coloring books are emerging as a medium for concentration and creativity. They're really assuming an importance, which I think has taken a lot of people by surprise. But it's a wonderful thing. So I'd like everyone to welcome Craig Cross to Many Rivers. Thank you for coming.
It's Cross, COSS. A very common mistake.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's a typo in there.
Yeah.
Wow.
It happens all the time.
All the time. My apologies.
No
but
problem.
Welcome to Many Rivers.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming on a rainy, blustery night. Some of you at very short notice, and some of you not intending to come here tonight for what is about to happen. This is the first book talk I've ever given.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I'm very excited that Jim at Many Rivers Books and Tea was not only the first shop to accept the book, but he was the first person to invite me to come and do a book talk. And I trembled at the idea and then thought, no, you know, this is gonna be fun. So this book is very dear to me. And the project goes back quite a long time, well before this summer, this last summer, when the New York Times published an article that linked adult coloring states of mind to meditation. The real inspiration for the book was my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, Suzanne Moore, who's a scholar of Carl Jung's work, very interested in archetypes and ancient history. And gosh, 12 years ago, it was so long ago, I don't actually remember when, she said to me, just casually, you know what I would really love? I would love a coloring book so that I could form a relationship with goddesses. Like, images of goddesses in different lands and different time periods, so I could color them, and by coloring them, get to know them better. And my heart just leapt, because I knew I had to be the person to do that. I had to do it. It was like an inner call immediately that responded. And I said, I'll make that for you, Suzanne. I don't know when. I'm teaching middle school. But when I can, I'll make that. And I think part of why I felt so deeply about the project is because my first art teacher when I was 3 years old was my aunt Marilyn Zarwell Stewart. And Mimi, as the family called her, was a ceramicist, a printmaker. She drew, she painted. She didn't sell much of her work. She sold a little bit. But in the late 60s and early 70s, she began to have dreams and visions, and without drugs, I'm convinced, and started shifting her mindset to worlds that she never knew existed before. And I know that she found a Jungian therapist and worked with this therapist to come to grips with what was happening to her. What was she seeing? What were these images? What was going on in these dreams, which seemed terrifying? And she started constructively working with these images in her artwork. And her sculptures went from dragons to gorgons with snakes all over their heads to garden goddesses. And before she died of breast cancer when I was 25, she had a show, Temenos, down at the Los Angeles Carl Jung Center there, the Jungian Center. And there was a 5.5 foot tall goddess with multiple breasts, all as a fountain, you know, spilling out. And when she died at her memorial service, it was her therapist who led the whole service. And I wasn't the only one that loved her. There were so many people in this church at USC that when I whispered into the therapist's ear, you know, I think Mimi wouldn't have wanted us sitting in pews. I think she would have wanted us in a circle. He said, "You're right." And he said, "Okay, everybody, we're going to stand up and we're going to make a circle." The church wasn't big enough to hold us. We were pressed against the walls to try to make a circle in this place. But Mimi held an energy that wasn't present anywhere else in my family. It was quiet. It was contemplative, meditative, introspective. But she was a relative whose leg I grabbed a hold on when I was, you know, a little kid and just wouldn't let go of and wouldn't let go. And she'd have to kind of peel me off. And but she did it with a smile. And I always felt that we had some kind of special connection. And in later I found out that she also felt that way, even though it was never spoken of. But one time when I was about 14 years old, I was in my grandparents' kitchen in Studio City, California, and I walked into the kitchen and only my aunt was there, and Life magazine, the current issue, was right there on the kitchen counter. And the cover of Life magazine was a night sky with huge stars, and it asked this question: who is God? And as I walked in the kitchen, she looked at this and she picked it up and she said, "Craig, who is God?" And coming from my beloved wise aunt, you know, the question just stopped me. I had nothing to say. And she said, "The answer? You want the answer? Who is God? I don't know, but she's black." And I giggled hearing that. And she looked at me and she said, "Why is that funny?" And she walked off. And I never forgot that experience. And I've been contemplating that since she told it to me, since I was 14. So when she died, after she died, and my mother-in-law years later said, "I want a coloring book," I knew it was my job to make it, because I remembered my aunt and her work, and I wanted to continue her contributions. So the first question I had is, well, what kind of book should this be? Should it be a book of goddesses that are out of my imagination, or should they be goddesses that I already know, goddesses from different places? I wanted to honor Suzanne, but I wanted to question, you know, what does the world need? What do I want to make? And I started doing my own rendition of goddesses, and it just didn't feel right at all. And I thought, no, that's not what this book is about. I have to get me out of this project as much as I can, and instead just look at traditional images from around the world throughout time and see if there's an image that I can find, or multiple images that still say something, that speak to where we are today. They have something to teach. And so that's what determined which goddesses got in the book. That's part of it. Some of it was the imagery. I saw an image and I thought, now this deserves 3 hours of study while you're coloring it. There's gonna be something that you're gonna find if you ask questions or if you listen. It's gonna pop out. But others, I had to go on a quest. I knew I wanted a certain goddess, and I had to go on a quest for the image. So, for example, I was hiking up, while I was in the middle of the project, I was hiking up on Mount St. Helena, north of Calistoga, that kind of looks over all of Napa Valley. It's one of the three big peaks in the North Bay. And I see near the top of the mountain a young man with a young woman, and they're looking at rocks on the side of the one forest road that goes to the top. And I love minerals, and so I asked them, what are they looking for? And cinnabar was the answer, and they asked about me, and suddenly we got into this conversation on top of the mountain. And next thing I knew, I said, oh, I'm working on this project. It's taken me a long time. It's going very slowly. It's a coloring book of goddesses throughout the world. And the young man said, well, is Oshun in the book? And I said, no, not yet. Tell me, who is Oshun? Tell me about Oshun. So he said, yeah, she needs to be in the book. And I felt, okay, whoever she is, she needs to be in the book. This is true, whatever he's saying. She's the Yoruba divinity of flow. When things work, when flow is going on, Oshun is present. When things aren't working, Oshun hasn't been recognized. She hasn't been acknowledged. She hasn't been invited into the project. Or maybe she doesn't want this project to flow. And the more I read about Oshun, the more I look into Oshun, the more I resonated with, yes, she needs to be in the book. But where can I get an image of her? Because getting the right image was essential. If I couldn't find the image, then no matter how amazing the goddess was, no matter how incredible the story, that was where I drew the line. She couldn't be in this particular book. So as I'm thinking about how to do this, I suddenly have an intuition. Go down to the library. I was living at Sausalito at the time. Just go down to the library. So I ran down, and I got a book on African art, and by Robert Ferris Thompson, who's one of the experts in African art in the whole world. He teaches at Yale. And at the end of the book, I see this incredible brass fan dedicated to Oshun. And this image is taken primarily from that fan that he photographed. It's now almost 100 years old, and a few other images of brass fans. So in some of these illustrations, I did a fusion of several illustrations or several different images, sculptures, or in this case, brass fans. And I brought what I thought was a synthesis that made it even richer. I took some license, some liberty there. And I did all of the illustrations in brush and ink and Sumi ink, kneeling on the floor, looking very carefully. I penciled them out first, and then I inked them. In fact, I spent so much time kneeling and inking that by the time I was done with the whole project, I had some serious wrist issues and my arm issues, because some of the work is so tight with a little ink brush doing all those little tiny lines. And a friend recommended an acupuncturist in San Rafael, an old Chinese guy, and I went to see him, and he took my temperature, looked at my tongue, took my pulse. No, he didn't take my temperature. He just looked at my tongue and took my pulse. And, you know, I told him what my problem was. And he looked at me and he said, you spend long time kneeling on floor? And I said, yeah, how'd you know? And he goes, yeah, not good kneel on floor that much time. So, oops, thank you. Well, there's a surprise for you. So, So that was a sign I'd done something, something a little bit extreme. But I got to talk to Robert Ferris Thompson when he came to the San Francisco Art Institute about this image. I thanked him, I gave him a copy of it, and he was so happy that there was a clear illustration, he said, of the fan. But this is one of the images that for me, you can get so much out of it. The more you look and the more you ask. Thompson cued me into this little square image here because he talked with the family who owned the fan there in Nigeria, and he said this indicated that Islam works well with her, that you can be a Muslim and still honor Oshun, that there's no contradiction, and so this may be the Kaaba. I asked him, what is this here? You have these fish and chickens. I had learned about chickens at the Oshun River in Nigeria that bathe regularly every day. They go and bathe in the river. But I asked him, what's going on here? And he said, well, look. See this fish with a stick in its mouth? Oshun's power is such that the terrestrial becomes aquatic, and the aquatic terrestrial. And one of my favorite things is this relationship between this serpent here and this bird. What is the relationship? Are they about to eat each other? Are they kissing? And just those two things, right? It's like the love and death. It's all there in this beautiful little meeting of the winged animal of the sky and the legless animal of the land and the waters. It's just so powerful. And even this labyrinthine path that winds around, that Oshun here with these fins, remember, she is flow. She has fin-like arms. She's either giving birth to or having a sexual relationship with, maybe both. But then you can see, wait a minute, this is a fan, so you hold this handle as you create flow and cool the air. But then this part becomes a knife. So there's a masculine symbology and a feminine symbology integrated together here. It's just, I could go on and on about this image. There's levels and levels of depth to it. But this is one where I got the inspiration from a stranger I met on a mountaintop, and the image, the source image came after that, all totally intuitively, and that's when I knew this is the right thing to have in the book. The man I met, Daniel Four was his name, he happens to be a priest of Oshun who studied with a Yoruban priestess who lives in Oakland. And he's now a shaman who does work with the healing different places around the country. So, other images. This great goddess of Teotihuacan, I know nothing about her story. But the image was too powerful not to include in the book. She is from a civilization that preceded the Aztecs by hundreds of years, and her city was massive. It was the sixth largest city in the world at that time. But we don't know her story. Her culture did have a hieroglyphic language. You can see her two priestesses here are maybe sowing seeds, and there's a little text that is being sung or a sound that they're making here, with these little hieroglyphs. And there are hieroglyphs in the trees, too. This is her owl headdress, and you can see her two eyes here and a tusk mouth belching forth water, and in that water are seeds and stars and flowers and aquatic animals, starfish. It's an incredible gift that she's giving. And then from behind her, or from her, these two trees intertwine with a double helix pattern, which is the same. Not only our DNA is a double helix, but twining rope or making basketry uses that helical pattern. So it's really universal, and it can create containment. It can create a basket or something stronger than a chain, as the Norse myth tells us, a rope. And with these two trees or two branches woven together, we see six spiders on one and four butterflies on the other. And to me, that says so much symbolically. The spider that weaves and beautiful patterns, but also has a stickiness to it, and maybe a poison, a devouring quality, and then the butterfly that goes from an ugly caterpillar to this beautiful, almost transcendental being. And so this is a very powerful image to me, and it was a real pain to draw.
Did you get real pain?
A real pain, yeah.
Now I'm wondering, when you drew those,
sure,
were they the same scale?
They were a little bit larger. I used 9 by 12 Bristol.
Yeah. Okay.
And then for this one, I actually went much larger.
I was going to say, because that looked, I mean, it's just, if you're down there on your knees, were you on a rug or on the wooden floor, or?
Yeah, no, thankfully I was on a carpet.
Okay.
But I'm a four planets in Virgo meticulous person, you know, with the small triple lot Winsor Newton Series 7 sable brush. I got really into it. This one of Coatlicue, again, an image-driven inclusion in the book. This one I did on a slightly smaller scale. And this is a massive statue. Have any of you seen the real thing? What is it like to be in front of it, Catherine?
It makes you ask a lot of questions inside yourself. Just like people who worshipped her, were they afraid of her?
Right.
You know, she was pretty frightening. Her story is pretty frightening.
Well, yeah, it's just the whole thing is kind of horrifying.
Where is she at?
She's at the Archaeological or Anthropological Museum in Mexico City.
Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are a number of them around there. It's, if you've heard the story of La Llorona, a lot of people base it on Coatlicue. They say she was the original La Llorona. Mm-hmm.
Catherine here is a well-known international storyteller now. Yeah. So what people don't always realize is that at the base of this 9-foot tall megalithic stone sculpture is this lady. Tlaltecutli.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tlaltecutli is the Aztec earth goddess, as far as we know. And while I was working on the project, in fact, I had almost all of the images done. This image was unearthed under Mexico City just in 2010, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is so significant. It's enormous. It would fill this room here. Yeah, it's this giant stone slab. They thought when they unearthed it, it was a lid to a tomb. And it was dated. I haven't put the date here, but the date was just a few years before Cortez and the conquistadors came and destroyed the whole Aztec civilization there. So, so this, it's like she came back to say hello, this goddess of the earth. And so I thought, okay, I've got to include her too. There's no more room in the book, so she goes on the title page. And very exciting. But there's a relief of her at the underside of the Coatlicue statue. So, yeah, so it's like the goddess that who is the earth is literally her feet or at her feet, or maybe she's growing up. Coatlicue is growing up from her. This image is also an interesting one. I wanted to include White Buffalo Calf Woman. Her story is so powerful. She's still a living presence in the Lakota today. And so I felt it's really important to include her in the book. But I wanted to find a native image, and not one that had been westernized. And so I did a lot of research. I mean, this book took years to make, and it was made slowly. So finally I found at the Smithsonian Institution their collection of winter counts. And winter counts were a way that the Lakota people kept track of history. And so on a stretched rawhide skin, starting in the middle and then working out as a spiral with one image every year, an artist in charge of the winter count would draw some kind of, or paint some kind of pattern, some kind of marking that would allow them to tell the story of that year just by looking at it. And so each year a new image was added and so forth until they spiraled out until you couldn't add any more on the skin. And I found one winter count by a man called Baptiste Good, or Brown Hat. And if you go all the way back, his winter count starts with the earliest historical record, and that was the coming of White Buffalo Calf Woman. And it was so beautiful. I think it's 11 teepees in a circle with markings for the four direction, the peace pipe, and a little smoke or breath coming up, and the white buffalo with milk underneath that she's giving. It's like the maize was the milk that she gave to the people. The original image didn't have a woman in it. And I sat with this and I thought, do I add a woman or do I not? And I found elsewhere on Winter Counts an image of a woman, and I thought, I think it's more powerful to put her there because she was both woman in her story. She's both woman and buffalo. She transforms to four different colors of buffalo and ends with a white one. So I made that choice to include it. So I did make calls, you know, occasionally, because I wanted them to speak to a contemporary person. I'm going to start in with a story about one of these goddesses, go in a little more depth. And tonight I'm going to tell the story of Lakshmi. And I've seen this image in it's actually a fusion of an image of Lakshmi from two stupas in central India, Sanchi and Bharut. And that's one of the places I've been. These are carved into stone, and they're very old, and they're Buddhist stupas. But this is a time when Buddhism and Hinduism were still very closely connected. And this image, when coupled with the story, has a very interesting interplay, I think. So I'd like to tell you the story and then return to the image. So there was an ancient sage named Durvasa, a beggar, a sadhu, who wandered the land, but who was treated with such great respect by all who came to meet him and see him, that some believed that he was not only a descendant of the great god Shiva, the destroyer of the universe, the god of yogis, but also the incarnation of Shiva himself, an avatar of Shiva. And Durvasa, walking through the forest one day, saw a beautiful heavenly nymph with a garland of flowers, a lei so beautiful that the bees were humming around the flowers. It was saturated with the divine essence, Shri. Now Shri, like Om, is an ancient sacred Sanskrit word that signifies, that carries with it the very divine luster of the universe. That which makes something precious, beautiful, sacred, present. And this garland was just impregnated, infused with Shri, and Durvasa, the sage, asked the little spirit, could I have this garland? And she said, oh, you certainly have earned it. And she gave it to Durvasa. Now, living in India for some months, I know that when a garland is given or put around the head of someone, you do that as a gift to divinity. So when you see divinity in an idol or in another person, when you go to the temple and the priest sees the divinity incarnate in you, they'll sometimes take those garlands off the idols and put them around your neck. And this is considered a great gift, a gift to the divine, prasad. And so Durvasa took this garland that he was gifted, and on his walk he met the king of the three worlds, Indra. Now, Indra is kind of like the Indian version of Zeus. He's a thunder god, he carries a big mace, he rides an elephant, and he's quite proud. He's got a massive ego, we could say. And he's riding his elephant through the forest, in his busy way, as a king should be, and the sage Durvasa approached him and said, great Indra, I give you this gift of this garland. And Indra took the beautiful garland, buzzing with bees, and put it on top of his elephant's head, as if, I don't want to have anything to do with this. He put it on top of the elephant's head, and the elephant, smelling this intoxicating fragrance, took it off his head, threw the garland to the ground, and then walked over it. Now, Durvasa was known for his temper, and it flared up at this moment, and he said, Indra, how could you do such a thing? That garland I gave you was saturated with Shri, sacred divine essence, and you have disregarded it and spurned it even. So, is that what you think? Is that how you feel? Is that your relationship? Then may Shri be taken from you and your world, and see how you fare. And Durvasa would not put up with any of his pleas and walked on. And the land of the gods of Devas, that Indra's heaven, turned gray and lifeless. Everything that interested them before was no longer interesting. The songs of the birds even just lost their magic. They lost their... The Devas lost their passion for anything. Their energy lagged. And their meaning seemed to just go away, and they didn't know where it had gone. Well, the Devas at this time battled in these wars with a titan race, the equivalent to the Greek titans called the Asuras. And we can call them also demons. They're translated in different ways. But the devas and the demons had this long-standing war. And when the Asuras felt the energy lag and the passion leave the devas, the Asuras, led by the demon king Bali, said, "Let's attack now!" And so they stormed Indra's heaven, and the gods, the devas, had no passion to fight. They had nothing in them. They had lost even a will to live, almost. And so behind the god Agni, fire, they fled. And they let Bali and his army of demons take over the three worlds and rule. And the devas were bereft, and they hid in the mountains. They thought, what do we do? The world is hopeless now. The demons have taken over, and we have not the strength and energy to fight them. And they realized they must turn to Brahma, the creator of the world. They must turn to Brahma and ask him. So they scaled many mountains and came to Brahma's dwelling, the four-headed god who was born from the lotus that grew out of Vishnu's navel. And they brought their problem before this great being. And Brahma told them, we must in turn go to an even greater being, the sustainer of the universe, the one who dreams existence. We must turn to Vishnu, because I do not know the answer to this problem. So Brahma led them out to the outer reaches of the world, to the abode of Vishnu, a scintillating abode of light. And when the devas beheld this light, immediately they bowed down with no volition of their own and prayed to it, "Great Vishnu, please help us. We are in too great a quandary. We have nothing, we know of nothing to do." And eventually Vishnu appeared in his blue skin form, with a chakra around his finger, the throwing star. And he told them, "Yes, you've gotten yourself into quite a pickle. And so you must recover Shri, what is lost. And you've lost everything now. So you must begin by making friends with your enemies. Go to the Asuras and make friends with them. Make peace. This you must do first." "Oh, but how can we make peace with them? We've been fighting them for millennia." "No, no. You must make peace. And maybe you can taunt them. Maybe if you ask them, if you tell them, you'll go on a quest for the nectar of immortality, the amrita. If you tell them this and that you'll share it with them, then they may strike a bargain with you and you can work together." And so the devas, still bowing, thanked great Vishnu, and they went with heads hung low back to their own palace, where King Bali was lounging there, very happy, and they begged Bali, "Please, can we work together?" "Why should we work with you? We have defeated you. Should we lop off your heads?" "No, no. We know how to get the nectar of immortality, the amrita, because Vishnu had told them where it lay and how to get it back. They must churn the great ocean of milk. Now this is the primordial cosmic sea that Vishnu is can be seen laying on, supported by a thousand-headed serpent, Sheshnag, dreaming and redreaming the universe. And from this sea, churning it, they may have a chance to get not only Shri back, but the nectar of immortality, the Amrita. So the demons, the Asuras, thought about it, and they agreed that if they shared it, if they shared everything that came from the churning process, they would work together with the Asuras. So their first task was to go to the ocean and throw many herbs and incense and the sweet things, a prasad, into the ocean of milk. But this wasn't going to really churn it. So again, they asked in their hearts Vishnu, because it is said that Vishnu is the soul of every person, dreaming their life as well. And so they asked in their hearts, and Vishnu told them, you must use Mount Mandara as a dasher to churn the ocean. Now, Mount Mandara was over 11,000 miles tall, an enormous vertical mountain. And it took everyone, the devas and the asuras, gathered around the mountain, digging at its roots to lift this thing and carry it to the ocean. And some say that they gave up midway and couldn't do it and required Vishnu to come on his mount, the bird or birdman Garuda, to come down and lift the mountain. Only then could it really be lifted. But in any case, they took the mountain and they turned it upside down and dropped it in the ocean of milk. And it sank. Gung, gung, gung. And they cried out, "Great Vishnu, how can we use the mountain as a dasher when it is sinking in the ocean of milk, which was endless?" And Vishnu, he came, he transformed and came as an avatar, an incarnation of a gigantic tortoise. And he dove into the ocean of milk and caught the mountain on his shell. And there the mountain stopped, partially above the milk and partially below. And then they asked Vasuki, the king of the serpents, the serpent who was rejected by all except Lord Shiva, who said, "Come, come, you can take refuge on my arms, around my neck." And Shiva wears Vasuki as his jewelry. And this king of the serpents, they asked, "Will you be the rope that we wind around the mountain and thus turn the dasher?" And the serpent said, "Yes, I will." And so the serpent wound itself around the mountain, and the gods went to take the head, and the Asuras said, wait a minute, we get the heads. Now, Suki had 1,000 heads, much like Sheshnag. And Indra said, okay, of course, go for it. So the demons took the head on the land on one side of the sea, and the gods, the devas, they took the tail on the other side of the milky ocean. And they began to pull, and then let the other side pull and pull, and the mountain, Mount Mandara, began twisting one way and then the other, back and forth in the milky ocean with all of this work. Now, the storytellers differ, whether it's from the Puranas or the Mahabharata, but they all say that from this process, a great poison, the Halahala, emerged. Some say that it emerged out of the sea, the turning process, and others say, and I like this, it came from the mouths of the snake itself going through this terrible ordeal of being pulled. But this It was a toxic gas that came out from this process. And the gas was so toxic that anything that touched it would die. Even the earth itself would die. And all were in terrible panic. Who can touch? What can we do with this poison? We can do nothing with it. We can only run. So the whole churning process ceased, and they prayed, Vishnu, Vishnu, save us from this gas. But only Shiva, the god of yogis, the destroyer of the universe, only he could take the poison. He caught it, some say, in a conch shell and raised it to his lips and drank in that poison that would kill the world. Now, some say that he kept it in his throat. He meditated and sat at Neelkanth, the place that I visited. He sat and he meditated for thousands of years, keeping this poison, this halahala, in his throat until it turned blue, and thus turned his whole body blue. And others say that his wife Parvati, who's Kali when she's not so angry, when she saw her husband drink the poison, she grabbed his throat and prevented him from swallowing. But in any case, Shiva kept the poison of the universe in his throat, drunk but not swallowed, until eventually over thousands of years it neutralized. And you can go to the place in northern India above Rishikesh in the mountains there, where it's said that Shiva sat and neutralized this poison. It's called Neelkanth, which means blue throat. It's a beautiful place. Well, now the churning could continue. And so back and forth, Mount Mandara churned the ocean of milk, and many other jewels or gems came rising up out of this process. One of them was the moon, which Shiva put in his hair. The other was the wish-fulfilling divine cow that gives milk to the world. A four-tusked, and sometimes people say seven-trunked elephant came from the process, a white elephant. And the goddess of wine, Varuni, came out, rose from this churning process. Now, the devas and the asuras, they said that they would share what came out of the churning. And immediately they started fighting over all of the things that started coming out of the milky sea. And who could they trust to divvy it up fairly but Vishnu? So Vishnu sat on top of the mountain and became the judge of who should get what. And as I was first told the story by the father of the family I lived with in India, Umang Vidarti, he gave Varuni wine to the demons first, so they would be intoxicated right away, and they wouldn't have a way to evaluate the merits of the other things that came rising from the Milky Sea. So wine went to the demons, and a horse with seven heads came from the sea. And the Kastuba, a beautiful jewel, the most beautiful jewel in the universe, came rising from the churning process. And this Vishnu took and put it around his own neck, around his, over his heart. And the churning continued. And the Asparsas, the celestial maidens, came rising out of the sea with their music and dance, and the churning continued. And finally, the most beautiful woman that anyone had ever seen rose from a lotus, with the elephants that had come out praising her, spitting, spewing the milk in the air. She was so beautiful. This was Lakshmi, And Shree returned to the universe, but now in a different way. Because before she was everywhere, here and there, and now she was in a focused form, this exquisite, human-like divinity. And she was given by the god of spring a beautiful garland, a garland that one gives to their chosen consort. And she took this, and looking at the Asuras and looking at the Devas, she put it around Vishnu's head. And from that time on, they were married, or they were consorts, they were paired. So this is how Shree was returned to the universe in the form of Lakshmi. But the churning kept going, because they wanted that elixir of immortality. And so the process continued. And eventually, at last, the divine physician of the gods came out of the ocean of milk with a jar, a vessel, an urn containing the Amrita, the nectar of immortality. Now immediately, seeing this, the Devas grabbed at it. They seized it the Asuras. They grabbed it, and they pulled it to them, and they fought over it. Mine, no, I'm going to have it. This is what we've been waiting for, but I get it first. And the Devas thought, how can we solve this problem? These monsters have taken this. They're unwilling to share, even among themselves, let alone to us. But Vishnu cleverly disguised himself and became Mohini, the enchantress, the most seductive being in the universe. And as Mohini, he came over to those Asuras and said, "Hey, fellas." And they turned and they said, "Whoa! Hey, how about we let her give us? Yeah, she'll distribute to all of us. Great!" She said, "Oh, I would love to do that. Why don't you just all line up in a line?" Oh, yes. So the Asuras, one by one, got in a line, and the Devas lined up behind her. And as Mohini flashed her eyes and smiled with an insinuating glance, she poured the Amrita into the mouths of all of the Devas, one by one. And the demons were fed on her glances and the curves of her body, for this is what they most desired. And the Devas got the elixir of immortality. Now, the very last Asura, the very last demon in the lineup, he watched this whole thing and he figured out what was going on. Hey, this is a trick! And at the last moment, he jumped to the other side of the line. And Mohini, since she wasn't looking at the Devas, she poured a little bit of the Amrita into this demon's mouth. And immediately the ruse was caught, and Mohini turned back into Vishnu, who cut off the head of this demon. And this demon was thrown into the sky, and the head became Ratu, Rahu, the north node of the moon, and the tail became Ketu, the south node of the moon. So, for you astrologers, that's the Hindu origins of those things. And it's said that when the eclipse of the sun or moon occur, it's because Rahu is eating the sun or eating the moon. And but Lakshmi, the lotus goddess, stayed with Vishnu, and she's depicted on Sheshnag with him, singing to him, often or almost always rubbing his feet. And she, as Mahalakshmi, she is the manifestation that we all live in. She is this dream of that Godhead, the material world, the spiritual world, everything that can be spoke of and measured, everything that is not the transcendent. And so so the reason I wanted to tell that particular story is because connected to the image the ocean of milk. She's rising up. The elephants are celebrating her presence, her appearance. She's offering milk to the world. But we have this vessel here. It's similar, perhaps, to the vessel that the Amrita was kept in. And so, it's, as you can see, the neck of the vessel is very narrow. It seems like an occult vessel, something that contains some mystery. But from that mystery comes forth the beauty of the lotuses, comes forth the opposites in these two elephants, and then this giving back. The elephants are pouring the ablutions, pouring some gift back onto the image of the goddess, saying, "Here, we give back to you." So everybody will have their own way of looking at this image, but while I was drawing it, for me, Lakshmi became, in a way, a very personal, very accessible way to connect to something extremely occult, extremely mysterious, unfathomable, and difficult to relate to. So it's as if she's an outer expression, in many ways like the saints in the Catholic Church are. They're intermediaries to some divinity that is beyond comprehension. And this is how I related to this image as I was drawing it. So thank you very much for hearing the story, and not only about the book, but about some of the images in the book, and to come all the way from India.
I love that story.
Do you know that story? Have you heard
it? Well, parts of it. You know, there's different versions.
Yeah.